think about this for just a second, if you would. The Federal Reserve raised interest rates today for just the second time in more than a decade. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, the 14th of December. Good to have you along, as it always is, everybody. First things first, yes, Chair Yellen and her colleagues on the Federal Open Market Committee did indeed raise short-term interest rates today, just a quarter of a percentage point, as we all knew was coming. But item the second, that's actually a good thing.
Let me say that our decision to raise rates should certainly be understood
There's a natural pause, by the way. She's a slow talker.
A reflection of the confidence we have in the progress the economy has made and our judgment that that progress will continue.
So there's that. Item three is this. In response to questions about the anticipated bump in federal spending once the president-elect takes over, fiscal stimulus is another word for government spending. Here you go.
I believe my predecessor and I called for fiscal stimulus when the unemployment rate was substantially higher than it is now.
Oh, snap. But wait, it gets better.
I would say at this point that fiscal policy is not obviously needed to provide stimulus to help us get back to full employment.
Translation, a little late now, Congress, huh? She was also asked, Chair Yellen was, about the president-elect's propensity to make economic policy via tweet. She did not touch that one. There is a question to be asked here about the rate hike, and it goes like this. Kai, for crying out loud, it's quarter lousy point. Why should I care? Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that one from New York.
A quarter percentage point ain't much, and we're only talking about the benchmark short-term interest rates the Fed sets. But that does impact you as rates gradually rise across the economy. Beth Ann Bovino is U.S. Chief Economist at S&P Global Ratings.
Basically, the impact will be borrowers will be losers and savers will be winners.
Not big winners. We're talking about interest on your savings account moving from basically nothing to, well, still pretty close to nothing. And if you want to avoid being one of those loser borrowers, a little advice from Nariman Baravesh, chief economist at IHS Market.
Certainly in terms of mortgages, I would say to the extent that homeowners or potential homeowners have the ability to lock in rates, this would be a good time to do it.
Mortgages don't move in lockstep with Fed decisions, but it is all connected. That includes variable rates on credit cards, which means it's wise to pay off any outstanding balances soon before rates rise. Car loans and student loans can feel the impact too. And if a quarter point hike still sounds small, stop thinking of it in isolation, explains California State University economist Sungwon Son.
This is just the beginning of a series of hikes in interest rates forthcoming.
Probably three next year, the Fed reckons. There's also the potential impact on stocks that may be sitting in your retirement fund. Stocks were down today. A rise in interest rates doesn't typically boost stock prices, but when the rise is driven by a belief in coming economic growth, that could be good for stocks in the longer term. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Everybody who's anybody in tech, almost, made the schlep to the corner of 56th and 5th in Manhattan today, Trump Tower, of course, for a meeting with the president-elect. It's interesting, this meeting, because during the campaign, tech writ large and the incoming administration got off to a not-so-great start. We called our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, to make me smart on all this. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So why is tech going to this meeting? What do they want to hear from the president-elect, do you think?
Well, you know, tech, as we have talked about on the show, has been the one topic that is conspicuously absent from the president-elect's agenda. He has not spoken much about it. It is obviously a huge driver of the economy and, you know, the future of the world, you could argue. I'm sure some of these tech leaders would
argue that.
I'm
sure that's what they're saying today, actually, in point of fact.
So I think they're there to find out what the future has in store for them.
So let me tick off a couple of things where they've had really serious disagreements. The first one that comes up, honestly, is encryption and privacy and the idea of, as we saw in San Bernardino, Donald Trump leaning on Tim Cook to unlock that doggone iPhone.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And we have already seen that some of his cabinet appointments or his cabinet suggestions are people who are in favor of, or at least conceptually seem to be in favor of, building backdoors into encryption,
right,
so that the government could break encryption when they need to. That is a conversation that the tech industry wants to be in on early. They want to know where he actually stands. And I think this is a question a lot of people are asking about a lot of topics. But in terms of tech, they're there to figure out where he actually stands and where they might be able to have some influence.
I found it interesting that the tech CEO who's not there, there are a couple who aren't there. The biggie, for my money, is Jack Dorsey, the guy who runs mm-hmm. Twitter, which is, as we all know, Donald Trump's favorite media tool ever.
Yeah, and interestingly, apparently was not invited.
Yeah,
just out of the country.
Right.
I think that is really interesting and telling, because the thing that Jack Dorsey has said is that the relationship between Twitter and Donald Trump is complicated.
Yeah.
That
literally that word he used, right?
He used that word, complicated. Yeah. But he's also hinted that, look, if the president-elect violates hate speech policies on Twitter, he could be banned. This is a conversation that has also happened. And it might be really, it could be as simple as just not wanting to, as Donald Trump not wanting to have that conversation with Jack Dorsey. I don't know.
There have been some high-profile tech world commentators who have said, basically, listen, you guys, tech that is, opposed him in his election. He has not said very nice things about you. You shouldn't even go to this meeting. Discuss mm-hmm. that.
Look, one thing I will point out is that every tech CEO who is attending, near as I can tell, is a CEO of a publicly traded company. You could argue that they have a responsibility to their shareholders to find out what the future holds for their companies. And from a purely personal perspective, if it's me, I just want to know. I think there is no way that you can say, I am going to establish myself in opposition to the extent that I don't even take the measure of my enemy. And that is assuming that they're looking at it that way. But there's a real possibility that these people are saying, these are businesses.
Yeah.
We have to figure out what the future holds for our businesses, and that they consider it the responsible move to make.
Molly Wood is our senior tech correspondent. Some news, actually, about me and Molly. We're doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart. Launches in January. The place to go is marketplace.org/makemesmart. Lots of details there. iTunes, that whole deal. Right, Mom?
The whole
deal. What else do I have to say?
Exactly.
That's it, right?
The whole deal. We may be talking about this topic a little further on an episode due out this week.
All right. Got to go. Bye.
Bye.
Due out today, in point of fact. On Wall Street today, traders need to get over themselves. It was a quarter of a lousy percentage point, y'all. All three major indices lower on the Fed rate hike and the Yellen presser. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Italy's new prime minister told that country's lawmakers today that he is ready to intervene to shore up Italian banks, some of which are deeply in debt and at no small risk of collapse. The government's in debt, too, though, which makes it harder to save another set of Italian assets, its many architectural treasures. Italy, it turns out, has more United Nations World Heritage sites than any other country. You think about Pompeii and the Colosseum and the Renaissance palaces of Florence, for just a couple. But all of that history is expensive to maintain, so the Italians have turned to the private sector for help paying for it, and more recently, to the Chinese as well. From Rome, Marketplace's Stephen Beard pulled the tough duty.
Walking on rickety scaffolding in a dark and dusty tunnel, it's hard to imagine this was part of Rome's most magnificent palace. Covered in gold leaf, it was called the Domus Aurea, Golden House, built by the Emperor Nero 2,000 years ago.
We discover this place in 1998.
Claudio Parisi Presice, head of cultural heritage for Rome.
We discover a painting that never was seen before.
Hardly anyone has seen it since it was discovered either. Today, the fresco depicting a scene from an unknown city is sealed off at the end of this tunnel with a giant plastic curtain. I'm one of only two dozen people alive who've looked at this painting.
Is it particularly fragile?
Yes, it's really fragile because the light and the humidity destroyed the pigments of the paintings.
Controlling the light, temperature, and humidity, let alone enabling the public to come in and gawp, would cost many hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's worth the money, says Philip Ditchfield, a British archaeologist who lives in Rome.
It's very rare where we can find an archaeological site and say this is a place where the emperor actually walked or gave a speech or gave a poetry recital. And it's well worth getting the money together to conserve this.
Nero's painting is one of many thousands of ancient artifacts that are crying out for conservation. The cash-strapped government here has turned to the private sector for help, asking companies to foot the bill for restoring and protecting some of the country's best-known architectural treasures.
A Colosseum. Do you want to go inside? Because we have guided tour companies.
The touts as busy as ever outside Rome's most iconic structure. The amphitheatre recently got a facelift thanks to a $28 million donation from a shoe company. Not total philanthropy. The company benefited from a new tax break. Daniel Berger, an American who works with the Ministry of Culture.
If you give money to a specific monument, you can deduct from some of your taxes around 65% of the total that's been given.
The tax break, launched 2 years ago, has raised almost $140 million for restoration. It's already reaped foreign rewards. A Japanese importer of Italian garments, says Berger, stumped up more than $2 million to refurbish a pyramid outside Rome.
He said, I got so much from Italy, I'm making a fortune by selling Italian clothes in Japan. Why don't I just do something nice for this country that's given me a tremendous economic opportunity?
The Trevi Fountain, spruced up with private money. The Italian culture minister has appealed for a further cascade of cash from China, which sells more than $30 billion worth of goods to Italy every year. Emmanuel Montini of Italia Nostra, a conservation watchdog, is a little wary.
We welcome any money from China, but with condition.
Montini and his colleagues are clear they don't want to see Italy's most precious landmarks plastered with billboards.
It's ugly. It's ugly. It's very ugly. It's important that the monument is respected.
But he's realistic. Exclusive photo shoots using the monuments are acceptable. After all, he says, Italy's unparalleled architectural heritage is under threat from tourism, smog, rain and earthquakes. But the biggest threat by far is lack of money. In Rome, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The Super Bowl is about a month and a half away, February 5th in Houston, if you're keeping track, which means companies planning to advertise during the big game still have plenty of time to put the finishing touches on those outrageously priced commercials or to decide to just skip the thing altogether. That is what Frito-Lay is doing. No commercials this year after a decade in the game, and they are not the only company sitting this one out. Marketplace's Jed Kim tells us what's going on.
Frito-Lay is the latest major advertiser to say it won't have any ads this year. Toyota also won't run any, which means we won't see things like its popular commercial from last year featuring bank robbers leading police on a super long chase.
On the scene with the Prius 4, authorities still in pursuit.
Unit 12, I'm out of gas on the highway.
Toyota and Frito-Lay have been major players, but the companies aren't taking the ball home and ending the game, says John Swallen of Kantar Media.
The Super Bowl will live. It'll survive the loss of these two advertisers. There will be other advertisers who willingly step up to take their place.
A 30-second spot could run about $5 million. That's something these veteran advertisers are considering more.
They may feel that there are other ways of spending that money within their marketing budget.
That's what Toyota says it's doing. Nick Amazalorso is a spokesman for the company. He says the automaker's still advertising during regular season games, but the Super Bowl just didn't work.
With no vehicle launches falling in that sweet spot of the February 2017 timeframe, we decided to forego our Super Bowl spot this year.
Still, the NFL's ratings have taken a hit lately. Daniel Durbin directs USC Annenberg's Sports Institute. He says even the Super Bowl's viewership has peaked.
People are beginning to see the rust around the edges of the NFL and see that the cachet of the Super Bowl may not be there on the same level that it was in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s.
He says a lot of people these days don't like ads. It's up to the NFL to figure out how to stay relevant with new tastes. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You know, I've had a lot of jobs. Boxer, mascot, astronaut, trucker, hippie, plow driver, food critic, conceptual artist.
Recognize that voice? What Homer Simpson's resume tells us about the middle class. But first, let's do the numbers. That rate hike? Yeah, the sky is falling. No, it's really not. The Dow Industrial is off 118.6%, 19,792. The NASDAQ off 27 points, about a half percent, 54.36. The S&P 500 sloughed off 18 points, 0.8%, 22.53. I love that word, sloughed off. Apple is flacking the heck out of its new iPhone game, Super Mario Run, comes out tomorrow. Today in Tokyo, the maker of the Mario games, Nintendo, down 0.9% stateside. Apple stock basically flat. A bright spot here, NVIDIA Corporation, the gang that makes PCs for hardcore gamers, is taking that expertise to the connected car market. What could possibly go wrong? NVIDIA shot up more than 5.8% today. Pay attention to bonds here. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note on the rate hike rose to 2.57%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The federal government spends more than $150 billion a year helping students pay for college. It's a steady flow of grants and loans, mostly. Economists have been debating for years, though, whether that money has been helping drive tuition up by making it easier for colleges to raise prices. President-elect Trump made that case on the campaign trail, and he has argued that the government ought to get out of the student loan business altogether. But as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports from the education desk at WYPR, the loan-tuition equation isn't all that simple.
In the late 1980s, then-Education Secretary William Bennett wrote a piece in the New York Times with the headline, "Our Greedy Colleges." He argued that increases in federal financial aid had enabled a steep rise in tuition. Here he is in a 1988 speech.
I am convinced that some institutions raise the price because they have to. I think it's also true that some institutions raise the price because they can.
Bennett has stood by that theory, and since then, the average sticker price at a private college has more than doubled, adjusted for inflation. But what became known as the Bennett hypothesis has been hard to prove. Taylor Nadald is an associate professor of finance at Brigham Young University.
There are so many other factors happening in the higher education industry.
Cuts to state funding, rising health care costs for faculty, the arms race for fancier science buildings and aquatic centers.
The argument would be it's just so hard to pin pricing increases on federal aid.
But a few years ago, Nadald and staffers at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York set out to try. They studied what happened when, in 2006, Congress significantly increased the maximum subsidized loan. Suddenly, freshmen and sophomores could borrow about $1,000 more per year. Sure enough, colleges with a lot of students who borrowed the maximum loan amount had the biggest jumps in tuition. After controlling for every other factor, Nadald says,
we estimate for every additional dollar of subsidized loans made available to students, institutions increase their sticker tuition about 60 cents.
Put another way, for every extra dollar students could borrow, colleges tacked on another 60 cents to the price. And that amounted to hundreds of dollars in extra tuition. The results were most pronounced at expensive for-profit and private nonprofit colleges, schools similar to Goucher College in Towson, Maryland. Current sticker price, about $43,000. That's where I found 19-year-old Danya Johnson, a sophomore from Baltimore, eating oatmeal at a campus coffee shop. She'll owe around $30,000 in federal loans by the time she graduates, about the national average.
I actually think there should be a cap on how much a college receiving federal funding can raise their tuition. They are like, well, the government will subsidize it, but it still puts a huge burden on students.
Junior Sarah Pacheco from Santa Barbara has help from her parents, though she'll be responsible for most of the debt.
How much have you borrowed so far to go to school?
I'm actually not sure, but I know I've borrowed a significant amount. It just seems far off.
Experts say that lack of awareness is part of the problem. Grants and loans that don't have to be paid back right away have a way of insulating students from the real price. Jose Antonio Bowen is president of Goucher College. He says for years, colleges only had to compete on quality.
Everybody was raising prices. Let's raise prices along with everybody else.
But that's changed, Bowen says, since the recession. Goucher has actually decided to freeze tuition next year.
There's more price sensitivity from consumers, so colleges are having to look at whether or not more people can pay, will they pay, and our pricing has started to be more important.
Critics of the New York Fed paper say the study only looked at a short period of time and only at sticker price. Colleges discount that price heavily for many students with their own grants and scholarships. Economist Sandy Baum with the Urban Institute has studied college pricing for years. She says even if there is some truth to the Bennett hypothesis,
in some sense, the whole purpose of the federal student aid programs is to increase demand. And so if there is some upward pressure on sticker prices, that's actually a small price to pay for the goal of making it possible for so many more people to go to college.
And if that aid went away, Baum says, it's clear lots of low and moderate income students would not go to college. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Homer Simpson is, by many measures, the typical middle-class American. He lives in a modest suburban house with his wife and his kids. He works what used to be a solidly middle-class job, and therein lies the problem, because after 27 seasons, the guy is still making what he was making at the beginning. Zachary Crockett writes for Vox, including recently a piece called What Homer Simpson's 100-Plus Jobs Tell Us About America's Middle Class. Zachary, good to have you on.
Good to be here.
Why Homer Simpson? I mean, what drew you to it?
Well, growing up, as everyone my age did, I was obsessed with The Simpsons. I'd watch this show every week. Homer was this, like, you know, iconic character. He was this goofy guy, lovable and kind of stupid at the same time. And one thing that really fascinated me about watching the show was to see how many jobs he held down.
You know, I've had a lot of jobs. Boxer, mascot, astronaut, trucker, hippie, plow driver, food critic, conceptual artist, grease
salesman. He kind of just ranged the entire economic spectrum.
And you added them up. There are like how many jobs? Like in 500 episodes, you had how many jobs? 100 plus, right?
So over 27 seasons, he's had 191 jobs.
His regular gig here, which, as you mentioned, is a nuclear plant safety inspector, he makes $37,416 a year. We know because we saw his paycheck at one point in season 7, right?
Yeah, in season 7, there's this great scene where it zooms in on his paycheck, and his two-week pay is $479.60.
Hey, how come my pay is so low?
That works out to about $11.99 an hour, and adjusted for inflation, as you said, that's a $37,000, $416 a year salary.
And what does that tell us about Homer Simpson and also the American middle class and how we think about it?
Homer has been a CEO. He's been a drive-through employee. He's had jobs that have paid the equivalent of $1 million in our real income, and he's had jobs that have paid $15,000. But despite all these successes here and there over the years, if you look at his median income and average it out, his income really hasn't increased over time. And if you graph out the American middle class in a similar way, their real income has stagnated since the 1970s, and economists have called this the middle class squeeze. So Homer Simpson and the American middle class have this strange thing in common in that society has continued to progress, but they've economically stagnated themselves.
Is there a thing where you look at Homer Simpson and you go, you know, he really is kind of every man? I mean, he's had all these jobs, his wages are stuck, he's busting his tail to get by, and yet he's just there.
Absolutely. And I think that's how a lot of economists are thinking about the American middle class right now, too. It's like we have this huge contingency of Americans who, as the national economic productivity has risen, what our money is actually worth in the economy has declined.
Zach Crockett is at Vox, where he writes, and he does graphics as well. His most recent piece is called What Homer Simpson's 100-Plus Jobs Tell Us About America's Middle Class. Zach, thanks very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer wasn't in that tech meeting at Trump Tower today. Could have been because she was busy dealing with another big hack, like a billion accounts big. The statement from the company this afternoon reads like this, quote, "We believe an unauthorized third party in August 2013 stole data associated with more than 1 billion user accounts." It goes on, "We believe this incident is likely distinct from the incident we disclosed on September 22nd, 2016. That one, you might remember, had 500 million accounts involved. It's worth noting here that Yahoo is in the middle of being bought by Verizon, or at least it is, you know, for now. The Fed raises, Wall Street swoons, as we all knew it would. The Dow off 0.6% today, and the NASDAQ down about 0.5%. The S&P 500, almost at A&P, down about 0.8%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.